Good evening. We'll go ahead and get started. So welcome to the April 18th meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission. And we'll get started with introductions. On our far left,
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Spencer Stegman, North Kitsap.
Rick Shattuck, Central Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, Central.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Gina Buskirk, Central Kitsap.
And Robert Baglio, South Kitsap. First item up is the adoption of the agenda. Any need or request to modify or adjust the agenda? All right, with that, I guess a motion for approval.
I move to approve the agenda.
Second.
I don't see a need for discussion. All those in favor? All right. With that, we will go to the approval of the minutes. These are the minutes from April 4th. Is there a motion for approval?
Move to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
Any discussion? Okay, hearing none. All those in favor? Opposed? Abstain. Get that. I would like to say I noticed everything was 5-0 with no discussion. It seemed awfully boring.
Anyway. You missed a good time.
Yes. So the next item is the administrative update, and I understand, Louisa, you're going to take the first couple, and then Jim is going to have the last couple. Is that correct? Okay.
Correct. Sorry, there's the wire here. I'm trying to get closer to the mic. I just have a really quick two items. The first one is the decision on when the start time is for the Planning Commission. If I understand correctly, I wasn't part of the discussion, but later on last year, there was a discussion about starting perhaps at 5:30, but I'm not sure if that's still the consensus with the Planning Commission. I just want to remind you that we did not put the start time in the new procedures for the reason that it will make it easier if you need to change that. However, having said that, I think the commission should still decide on the start time. If you want to move it to 5:30, we can change all our publication to reflect the new time. And perhaps we will add it to the, may not be the next Planning Commission. It depends on the hearing date because the commissioner is going to adopt it on April 24th. So after that, if the Planning Commission wants to make a motion to decide on the time frame, then we will memorize that with our publications. So this is just a reminder. If you want to, we will add it to the discussion for the next agenda for you to discuss and make a motion to adopt to start time.
All right.
The second thing is about KNAT, and I hate to use acronym, and even today I tried to figure out another acronym that I didn't know what that stands for. And KNAT is really Kitsap Nuisance Abatement Team. This is not really within so much of the Planning Commission's purview, but it's interesting information to share. We have not had a co-enforcement officer for almost a year. So we have a lot of issues. Sheriff's Office and Health District stepped in to do as much as possible. Because in the last KNAT, is Kitsap Nuisance Abatement Team, it consisting of Sheriff's Office, Health District, Public Works, Sanitation, sometimes it's Animal Control, it depends on the issues. There's a long list of people get involved. But because of the lack of resources, it kind of didn't happen for a long time. So there were a lot of properties keep adding to the nuisance list to be addressed. And so now that we have two very amazing co-enforcement officers on staff, we try to reactivate the group. And we actually have our first kickoff meeting today, and we looked at the memorandum of understanding so that we all understand our obligations and what we need to do. And essentially, this particular team is going to be led by DCD. So we facilitate, and we also have to figure out where to find the funding as well. So, but we're still going to tackle all the issues, and because there's a lot of properties on the list, some are much longer than really it should be. And so if you hear anything, if you have any questions, by all means, let us know. Tamara forgot her last name. She's new. She's the point of contact. So if you run into any situations that you don't know what to deal with, you feel it's a nuisance complaint, you can always send it to me and I'll forward it to Tamara. Sorry that I just her last name slipped my mind.
Griffey.
So do you have any questions on that or even the start time?
Tom?
Yes, I have a general question on on code enforcement. You mentioned it. I noticed there was a rush to the counter of applications to try to vest before the stormwater code was put into effect. What is DCD telling those people, the 46 applications, I believe it was, that came in just before the code was adopted? Given that the Supreme Court has indicated that those kinds of state environmental rules do not vest, what is DCD telling the applicants at this point?
I don't think we have anything to offer at this point because our legal has not, our prosecutor's office is still reviewing the situation, so nothing has been determined at this point. I'm sorry, I don't have the answer for you, and I don't know how much I can say at this point.
So are those applications on hold?
No, we continue the way it is until we hear otherwise. And I don't think even the court decision is finalized at this point.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Okay. So the next two items is...
Jim. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. Jim Bolger, Department of Community Development. I wanted to bring to the Planning Commission's attention two kind of upcoming items that we'll bring back to you in subsequent meetings, but I wanted to give you a heads up. These are not really matters that the Planning Commission will be taking action on, but the board asked us to bring it to your attention. One of those issues is the Ag Code update. There was a undoing of the Ag Code changes that were done this previous summer. When the county updated its agricultural code in Title 17, it made a number of changes on the use tables. Mm-hmm. Well, 2 weeks later, we came in and we passed another ordinance that included the maximum lot size for urban growth areas. Well, because those two efforts were running concurrently, the maximum lot size ordinance basically reinstated all of the changes we had done in the Ag Code. So our code publisher identified this undoing of the Ag Code changes. So the board has decided to adopt an emergency ordinance that they'll be considering in May. There will be no changes to any of the provisions that were adopted back in, I think it was July or August. And so they're just going to go ahead. We'll be taking the findings from the Planning Commission's earlier hearings and record of decision, and we'll be presenting that to the board. So they're going to move ahead with that just to make sure we can get everything cleaned up and get the online version of the codes up to date as quickly as possible. And the second item is another housekeeping issue that kind of has been languishing from back in the fall, and that is transfer of development rights elements in code reference a resolution to be passed by the board that establishes the exchange ratios between receiving areas or sending areas and receiving areas. I believe this has come before in a kind of an informational way before the Planning Commission, but the board is interested in adopting that resolution. That also does not have to come before the Planning Commission, but we'll be presenting it to you at your, I think, May 2nd meeting. We're going to have a brief presentation on what those ratios are. We said we'd bring it to you for your information, solicit any comments you have for their consideration when they're looking at adopting the resolution, establishing those ratios. So I just wanted to put that on your radar. We'll provide you materials ahead of those meetings so that you're prepared to look at the changes that are being proposed. So, any questions?
Okay. Questions? I have an unrelated question.
Okay.
So last meeting, you were announced as Assistant Director for DCD's PEP. That's the permitting and...
That's Planning and Environmental Programs. Okay. So that's kind of the long range and environmental programs, all the Puget Sound recovery, salmon recovery work that the department participates in.
And then the DSE?
And that is the current planning as well as the development engineering side of things, so as well as environmental review.
Okay.
So Scott Diener is the manager of the DSE program, and we're currently advertising for a program manager for the planning and environmental programs.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Mm-hmm. So next, I guess we have the work study with Kathleen Barnhart.
All right. Can you hear me all right if you're here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Kathleen Barnhart, DCD, Pacific County, and as you know, we're here again tonight to discuss the Critical Areas Ordinance update. So I want to start out by going through just sort of an outline again for tonight. It'd be very similar to last time. We're going to go over the schedule. Going to talk a little bit about our comment response matrix, which just went out today, and then finish up going through each of the chapters that we have remaining, starting with the Fish and Wildlife Habitat Conservation Areas. And I planned on going through it the same way we did last time, unless there are any objections. I guess this would be a good time to talk about the comment response matrix. So we had compiled all of the comments that we have received through the March public comment period, the 30 days. We have attached all those to the website. They're up and available now. And that's all of the comments as they were submitted, as well as summarized each comment, as well as summarize the issues with the county response. So there are three different ways you can look at the comments and the county's response, and that's available. So folks will have that to review, as well as the draft, before and through the hearings, which we're going to be starting next week. So you have two hearings next week, Tuesday and Thursday, and one the following Tuesday on May 2nd. Anything to add? Yeah, so in addition to the comments that were received online, we also have PDFs of all of the letters, the hard copy submissions that we received or posted as well.
So just out of curiosity, this is the updated, right?
That's all of the new stuff that went out today.
So how many pages is it? It must be getting a little large. That's why it's on a disk, yes?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. At some point, is there actually going to be, is there a column on what the county is going to do or how they're going to respond to it? Is that going to come later after the public input? Oh, it is on there now. Okay.
Okay. So some of the comments, you'll see that the county is proposing revisions or deletions or based on public comment. That's actually, will also take into account any recommendations that come out of the Planning Commission as we move forward to the board. Department will support. Battery's a little low.
Okay. So we'll take into account your deliberations and recommendations to the department as we move forward to the board. So we don't at this point intend on creating a second draft of the actual ordinance itself.
Okay. Thank you.
So this is just the schedule, as we pretty much just discussed. Following the hearings, we'll have deliberations in mid-May, followed by findings of fact in early June. And open houses, yes, before each of the hearings. So that from 5 to 6, we will have open houses at each of these venues before the hearings. And then the hearings, of course, start at 6, the regular meeting time.
So question at the hearing, how much are you going to give a brief overview prior at the start of the hearings, or how are we going to structure that? And we could probably talk about it maybe later, I guess, but just kind of curious what, just so we understand what to prepare for.
We don't have all the details on that, but staff will probably make an overall presentation on the process that got us to that point, along
okay.
with a summary, not specifically of the comments, but the process of pulling the comments together, kind of to set the context for the hearing for the most part. I wouldn't anticipate it would be more than 15 or 20 minutes of a staff presentation before you can open up the hearing for testimony. But we still will figure out the details and let you know what to expect.
Okay.
With that, I'll just get going here. So the first chapter we're talking tonight about is 19.300. That's the Fish and Wildlife Habitat Conservation Areas, starting on page 70. First subsection, 305, Purpose. The first change you'll notice, say this chapter applies to all, again, we've struck regulated throughout, to all uses within or adjacent to Fish and Wildlife Habitat Conservation Areas. So we've had a lot of comments about just needing to define adjacent. We are proposing some clarification for this title, so just so you're aware of that. Further on down here, we have an addition of no net loss of critical area functions and values has been added, and that's on line 13. And then some grammatical edits throughout the rest of that section. And then I would point out that the D on line 21, that was inadvertently left out as an addition. That is new. To avoid or minimize human and wildlife conflicts through planning and implementation of wildlife corridors where feasible. That was a recommendation of the working group from last summer. And fits very well, actually, with a lot of the changes made throughout. Any questions on section 305, purpose? No. 310, Fish and Wildlife Habitat Conservation Area Categories. First addition here is that they may occur on both public and private lands. That's an addition from the WAC, again. And then in subsection B, the classification and designation of those areas. There we go. I'll do two things at once, I promise. So with B1, with streams, you'll notice that the type S has been removed, and there's some language on the next page that's been added to clarify how type S streams are regulated now under our Shoreline Master Program. It goes on to discuss how DNR maps are not the only source, nor should they be, as the WAC states, and that other modeled or field verified stream types, stream type maps should also be used. And it also discusses field verification. The WAC also goes on to say, and we've added that here, this last sentence, that the field verification should occur during the wet season months of October to March, if feasible, or as determined by the department.
So what criteria is the department going to use to determine whether I've got a fish-bearing stream if I come in April and say, geez, I don't think I have a fish-bearing stream? What criteria is the department going to use in determining what should be done?
Yeah.
Part of our environmental review team.
I'm the current.
You're the guy going to decide. Okay.
Correct. Well, what's done now currently in relation to whether stream is fish type or non-fish type is that if there is a question related to that, we typically ask the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and often the co-manager, which is whatever the specific tribe member, tribal biologist, would go out and make a determination in relation to making the call whether or not something is fish type or not. And that works fairly well at this point. If there is no effort made on the part of an applicant, the applicant can also hire a fisheries biologist to also make that determination. And then what's happened in the review of that application is that the Fish and Wildlife managers, co-managers, are then given a chance to review the document. Okay. Yeah, that works pretty well.
So V2, the lakes, because we have removed the shoreline pieces, we wanted to make sure that we had something about those lakes less than 20 acres. So that section is still there. However, the shoreline portion of that, it has been struck, as you can see on the bottom of page 71.
I do have a question going back. The field verification. It says, I believe it says should or as determined by the department. I guess I was curious. I mean, obviously, this potentially could result in the fact that these applications are only reviewed and processed during those times of the year and during other times.
Oh, sure. Right.
Nothing would take place.
Yes. So
I guess I'm curious. It seems to be a little.
There are scientific methods to determine bank full width of a creek. And then in the determination of bank full width, there's also the analysis that happens, and that can happen out of season, if you will, or out of the time of a stream flow. But the essential 2-foot wide bank full width is the State Department of Natural Resources criteria. And then fish blockage from a downstream obvious fish type, and there's a protocol for how that's done, and we follow the protocol today. All of the fishery managers follow the same protocol. They're all trained in stream typing, as our county staff too, in that methodology.
So unless there was maybe a disagreement between a wetland consultant,
yes,
and the reviewer,
right,
more than likely you wouldn't necessarily have to do a wet season review.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. And there, I'll explain further that there are several identified non-fish streams throughout the county. In fact, there are streams that aren't even mapped that are definitely fish type. And one I can think of that's pretty doggone close to being actually a shoreline type of creek too. It's a big enough flow. It's just not very well mapped. There's a new mapping effort, though, so that'll be part of this. Yeah. It's a really good question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. So moving on then to page 72 for the B3 wildlife habitat conservation areas. This is where we talk about the two classes of areas. There's class 1 and class 2. So subsection A, 1 and 2. So the first part, DFW priority habitats and species have been specifically added as an including but not limited to database and resource for identifying these areas, because that list includes the endangered, threatened, and sensitive species, both state and federal. And then subsection 2 there, wildlife areas, WDFW wildlife areas was specifically called out in the WAC to be included for this class 1. Habitat areas. And then I'd point out in B for class 2, you'll notice that we have struck that the species documented in maps or databases available to Kitsap County and its citizens. Not all priority habitats and species locations are public for very good reason, and that is to protect like specific sensitive nesting areas. So there are some species that are specifically not made public for that reason. And then we've also added to maintain a viable population, again, an addition in the definition from the WAC. Right, moving on to subsection 315 then, the development standards for fish and wildlife habitat. So we've added changes to clarify it's not the critical area or buffer that's subject to the regulations, but rather the development activity. So that was just a small change in the language to clarify there. And then moving on to A1, We've deleted, it says buffers or setbacks. We've deleted or setbacks. Setbacks are not intended to remain undisturbed. And this section actually is specifically about buffers. So moving that out. You'll notice the table. Again, the streams, the shoreline streams have been struck there. Saltwater shorelines on the next page, which discuss the different shoreline designations, and the lakes have been removed. Lakes less than 20 acres was actually added, again, because they wouldn't be covered under the shoreline management program. And all the buffers there remain the same.
Tom? Yes, I'm a little confused as to where we are here. I'm looking at 315,
mm-hmm.
and this is something called D stream crossings, and it mentions that state and local regulations apply. It calls out the water crossing design guidelines are encouraged.
You're a few pages ahead of us.
Oh, I am? Okay.
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
We're on page. Okay. We're on.
Raise your hand when you get that, please.
Will do. Yeah, we're on the table on page 73. I'm just about to flip over to 74 here.
Right.
See, now I've lost my spot. Okay. The next change, then, you'll notice that the original A3 has been deleted. This is the buffer width and setbacks for shorelines. New A3, the provisions for decreasing the buffer. These first changes are really about clarifications and just some grammatical changes. Until you get to toward the bottom there on page, line 11. The reduction is the minimum. If the department may grant a reduction if it determines a reduction is the minimum necessary for the permitted use and that the conditions are sufficient to assure no net loss of ecological functions of the affected fish and wildlife habitat conservation area. It goes on to say the department may reduce the buffer width by 25% from 50% in a type 1 permit under chapter 20, so under title 21. And type 1 decision is administrative.
So why was the reduction? That's a fairly significant change. What was the rationale for that?
The rationale for that was very similar to what was provided for wetlands. It was the same. Same justification. So, best available science is what it was saying.
And again, when you say that, that doesn't mean much to me unless I know the source. So the best available science, is this something out of CTED, something out of Olympia?
It's ecology's guidance, and they provided it particularly for wetlands, going with a standard buffer width.
Right.
They take a moderate risk approach, and so they say if you're going to apply buffers, a buffer width of this much, you have a moderate risk of harming the functions and values. And what the Department of Ecology had said in that instance is that you can administratively reduce that buffer by up to 25% in a situation where you're doing a buffer averaging type scenario, but they're not being supportive of a administrative reduction outside, and we've received comments from them on this. They're not being supportive of an administrative reduction outside of a buffer averaging scenario.
Jim, I'm aware of the advice on wetlands, but this, of course, these aren't wetlands. These are, and so is this a decision by our department to apply the wetland best available science in this area?
Well, the buffers attributed to wetlands are also aligned very closely with providing the values and functions of stream systems as well, which is where a lot of these kind of ecosystem elements apply. So, you know, smaller buffers can be appropriate for water quality concerns. You start getting the larger buffers to preserve kind of more of the habitat and wildlife functions.
But again, my question is, what's the source of this best available science with regard to fish and wildlife? And as I understand, it's the department.
The department is right. And has, in the current CAO, allowed administrative reductions of up to 50%.
Right.
And based on the input from ecology and the review of the best available science last summer, the technical groups that reviewed this came forward and said, well, we should reduce this to 25% based on the information provided to those groups. I can't give you a specific citation of the paper, but what we're proposing in this draft is that despite the fact that ecology is recommending no administrative reductions at all outside of a buffer averaging situation, we think that there should be still some level of administrative reduction allowed as long as that's guided by expertise of a professional wetland scientist or, in this case, a habitat biologist.
So, is that question?
Yeah.
With some of the information you gave us previously, there's the critical errors, ordinance update, best available science review. I mean, does that contain the majority of, I guess, information or data that's been used to make these modifications, all the significant studies and things?
I think the summary of best available science and the bibliography, it's contained in there. There's also, in 2005, there was a white paper on the best available science that the county conducted, and if you notice, that's, we're not changing the buffers in these fish and wildlife conservation areas from what they were back in, or currently are, I guess. And so a lot of that same information that was used to develop the standards in 2005 apply still. Hasn't been a lot of new science in this particular area since then, unlike wetlands, which has had more significant gain in information.
Okay.
That's good. I will add, if we keep going, this how this differs from the wetland scenario, where we've deleted some of the SFR and shoreline language, we've also said that reductions greater than 25% for single-family residences would be reviewed as a Type 2 decision, and that they could go up to 50%, or down 50% for single-family residences with the stream situation. It would just be under a different type of review process. And then a variance for all other uses greater than a 25% reduction. So it does differ currently in this draft from the wetlands chapter. So if we turn the page then to 76, not there quite yet, Tom. 5 and 6, ravines and channel migration zones. We've added clarification to both that the setbacks for geologically hazardous areas may also apply. Just as kind of a note to check that other standards may apply in those situations. Moving on to A10 on the next page then, the buffer and building setbacks for water-dependent activities. We deleted this paragraph. The provision for water dependency is in the Shoreline Management Act and doesn't apply in this particular case anymore. Moving on to B, Class 1 wildlife habitat conservation areas. First change you'll notice is that we've changed from sites versus development permits. It's about the permit, not all others. So that's the first change you'll notice. And then there's a language here to change, as we discussed before, the bald eagle language that we have. We've gotten some clarification from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're now under the impression that a requirement for the HMP, the requirement for an HMP habitat management plan, may be going away if we can condition the permits for construction times and avoidance of nest trees and that type of thing. So it's more of a conditioning the permit rather than a full-on habitat management plan for those.
Okay.
Moving on to C, which is not on the slide here, I apologize for that. the SEPA review is actually is what determines if a HMP is needed for class 2 habitat. And now we're at D, stream crossings.
Question on that one, if I could. So I guess right now, don't typically you have the HMP, and that's actually circulated as a part of SEPA? Or because it seemed like I'm working on that right now on a project in Paulsbo. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have to go through SEPA again, right, once you – if SEPA requires the HMP, you don't have to go through the process again, correct?
Right, yeah. So depending on the complexity of the application and that type of thing, often an activity is SEPA exempt, so you wouldn't require that. But if it's a higher order permit, say a conditional use permit, or one that triggers a SEPA decision, then that would be reviewed at that time. Yeah.
Okay. So it would be a SEPA or critical area review on the project.
Yeah.
So as you're triaging and moving projects through, you would look at them, determine at that time if that further information is needed,
right,
which is how we operate today.
Yes.
So I guess just playing that through, so you take the information, you circulate your SEPA to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and to the tribe. It comes back, you have to do an HMP, but your SEPA is approved. You then do an HMP. They actually get a second review on it again because they're going to review and comment on it, correct?
They would review it again. Yes, that's correct. But that's part of the – that would be part of the review of the application anyway. Yeah. So that would – yeah.
Okay. It just seems like we typically do all our studies beforehand and circulate them with SEPA, then they give their comments. They don't necessarily have the ability to comment on it twice. That's why I guess looking at that, I'm just kind of thinking of that.
Yeah, that's a good thought. What we have typically done in more complex projects is through those staff consultation meetings, we do discuss that. So we'll say, hey, this is a SEPA level of a project. And so we'll have that certainly rolled in as a discussion point in those meetings. And certainly in an hourly meeting or a pre-app or something like that, we'll have that discussion too. Mm-hmm. But that's a really good point. Yeah.
Okay.
D, stream crossings. We've added that other state and local regulations apply, and that the use of the Department of Fish and Wildlife guidance from 2013, water crossing design guidelines are encouraged. And the reason we've added the encouraged word in there is because these guidelines from DFW are not intended to be regulatory, but they are, however, used by DFW staff when reviewing for their hydraulic project approval permits, so their HPAs. We want to make sure we're consistent and that the project is going to meet both the county standards and DFW's requirements.
My concern here is, does this language prevent the installation of fish-blocking culverts, which we are now trying to remove throughout the state?
That particular paragraph or this section?
In our code, we have a critical area code. And I just haven't found yet where we are not making the same mistakes that we have made in the past in order to inexpensively access property and incur a future debt.
Mm-hmm. Most of this section is remained unchanged with a few exceptions. And I can't speak to how this has been implemented previously. The change that you see here on one is actually not new. It's just that one and two have sort of switched orders just for it reads better that way. We've also changed it from spawning areas to salmonid stream.
Right.
So, and that's important because different parts of the stream are going to be more critical for different life stages. So it's not just the spawning areas we're concerned about, it's the system as a whole. So that could potentially change how far-reaching these provisions apply, as far as bridges and bottomless culverts being a requirement. The other thing, piece that we've added in 3 on page 78, bridges and pier abutments shall not be placed in either the floodway or between the ordinary high water marks unless no other feasible alternative placement exists, the portion added, or to provide mid-span footings for the purpose of increased floodplain connectivity. This did come from the technical working group, correct?
Was Public Works on that?
They have reviewed it. I don't believe they actually commented on that particular issue. Yeah.
Okay.
But we'll follow up with them. E, stream relocations. Some grammatical clarifications here in this first sentence. It was reading kind of strangely, but it comes out meaning the same. Stream relocations shall not be permitted unless. In E1, we replace should with a shall be replanted and maintained. It's one thing to say that they should be replanted, but to ensure that that gets followed through, they shall be replanted and maintained for these stream relocation situations. And often these are typically your restoration projects anyway, so... And this is when it's required by habitat management plan. So this isn't something that's just being going to be made up on the spot. This is something that's been approved, and you've had your biologist make that determination. And F, the pesticides, fertilizers, and herbicides. This is the same paragraph that we had in our wetlands chapter as discussed last time. So G1, land use and land use permits. Under 1, the open water areas. Shall not be used to calculate the minimum lot area rather than permitted for use in. Shall not be permitted for use. Noting the typo that we've had here that will be corrected, should be H actually, not G, agricultural restrictions. So again, this is the same section that we discussed with wetlands. We are proposing to add that if the land is enrolled in a federally recognized conservation program, it is not considered to be idle and meets the existing and ongoing ag definition. So based on feedback that we've received, that was one of our responses in the matrix based on public comment.
On that particular one, it brought me a little pause, given that the conservation district is really not a regulatory agency, and they just try to make things a bit better than they were. Is that good enough for agriculture, but not good enough for...
I can probably talk to that pretty well, because I come from conservation districts from the early 90s. But the fact that conservation plans they're multi-phased. So there can be a resource management system farm plan that's in place for an operation that is a regulatory document, and it has weight, and it's designed to a specification provided by the federal government. So the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service and farm planners have to take, if they're a certified farm planner, they have to take courses. They have to be vetted, if you will, in that particular process, and you actually get a stamp and everything, you know, to have that kind of ability to write that level of a plan. So the whole thought for, say, for instance, the open space program, if you're enrolled in the open space program, you, for farm purposes, you have an actual RMS, it's called the RMS plan, resource management system plan. It's a full drawn out plan. It's very, very specific and deals with soil, water, air, plants, and animals and people.
And that I will add that that is the reason that we changed the language from just a farm plan to the specific farm resource conservation and management plan, because it is a specific thing and it does cover more than just stormwater,
right,
or water quality issues rather. So it's maybe not as clear if you're not familiar with that particular plan or that term, but to the folks who deal with ag, it would be a very distinct type of plan.
And it would be a plan that a typical landowner would, there would be no way a landowner would be able to develop their own RMS plan. They could do it with assistance. They can also pay to have someone else develop that plan if that person that developed the plan had that background and the ability to stamp a plan. Yeah.
All right, moving on. Under H, trails and trail-related facilities, again, this is the same as we had in 19.200 wetlands, and also is consistent with what we had adopted for our shoreline master program as far as the width of trails and the trails and trail-related facilities being the outer 25% of a buffer, unless you have direct access for viewing areas, platforms, and that sort of thing. For I, for utilities, we've added that placement also applies to the buffers. So it's not just if you're placing a utility in the buffer, but or in the critical area, but also in the buffer. For 3, construction of sewer lines or on-site sewage systems may be permitted in these areas or their buffers only when. So we've clarified that by adding only. And for 5, we have added the utility corridor construction and maintenance shall protect the environment of fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas and their buffers by utilizing the following methods. And then we have listed the first one there is the same. We've added unless there's no reasonable alternative location, so that is new. And then for B, we've added an order of preference for new utility corridors being located either on an existing road, an existing bridge, or placed deep enough under the culvert to allow for future culvert replacement and avoid grade barriers. And this just goes to using our existing infrastructure to not create further impacts to the environment by creating a new utility corridor if we already have one in place that it could be located on. And then here at the end of 5 and 5C, mitigation will be required for any additional access through restoration or vegetation in disturbed areas. So if you have to create an access to your utility, there would be mitigation required for any disturbance to that access easement, if you will. J, bank stabilization, here on the next page. We removed the references to bluff and shoreline where appropriate.
I'm just curious. So, like on this item there, typically with any type of utilities, it's a continuous easement that runs across the property, and usually, obviously, it's there and the width is there, so you can actually maintain the utility that's in it. I would assume Puget Sound Energy, Cascade Natural Gas, some of those guys would probably have some heartburn. I don't know if you've received any feedback from them. It just seems like this might not be realistic from a maintenance standpoint. I was curious if they've commented on that at all.
We have not received comments on this particular
question. Okay. Provision.
All And back to bank stabilization. Again, remove references to bluff shoreline where appropriate and replace the channel or bank or channel migration zones, which would be more applicable to our streams and lake shorelines. And then down here at M, very bottom here, we road street repair and construction. We've added number five here, mitigation shall be performed in accordance with specific project mitigation requirements. Seems like it shouldn't have to be said, but it's sort of the end of the sequence here that if there are mitigation project mitigation requirements, you need to do that. Any further questions or comments on fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas? Okay. We're going to move into chapter 400, geologically hazardous areas. So the first thing you'll notice right off the bat is that this section is very different. Again, we have rewritten this one. It would have been very difficult to even read if we had done an underlined strikeout. Of the way it was organized previously. So it's a reorganization, much of the same, if not all, of the previous or the current code is still here. So A, new paragraph added, language was taken from the updated WAC chapter. The intent items that you see, 1 through 5, remain the same. And then the paragraph for B was added to clarify application of code to activities requiring project permits and clearing, but not for testing or surveying. So if you had to have someone come in and do some boring and test drills or something to even do the study, that part itself would not require it unless they had to, again, create some sort of road construction to get to the site to do those testing pieces.
Kathleen, if I can ask just a question about approach, we're coming up for our public hearings. In the last set of public hearings we had, we didn't have an overlay where you could take this down to the lot level so someone could see what kind of impact this was going to have to their property. Mm-hmm. Are we going to have the same issue when we go to these next set of public hearings? Or are we going to have any ability to show a landowner exactly what this will do to them?
So right now, we don't have the ability to put draft maps from, it's a policy decision, I suppose, into the current parcel search application. That was part of the reason we wanted to create the online open house piece, and realizing that there are a lot of data, and so it is very difficult, and the PDFs may not be the best quality. So we will look into what our options are from.
So what's next week? As of right now, the answer is no, we don't have a way for people to come to the hearing and see what the landslide areas
are going to be. Nothing than what we don't already have out right now. So moving in then into 410, general requirements. So for A, these are the standards that shall apply to any activity or clearing in an erosion or landslide area. To comply with the geotech when required, including the recommended largest buffer, utilizing the industry best management practices, complying with our Title 12 stormwater and to prevent collection, concentration, and discharge of storm and groundwater. 4 has been retained. 5 was deleted because it's redundant of 4. And then B are the standards for shall not actions in erosion or landslide areas. And these are retained from our current. C, field marking requirements, is retained. So D, clearing, grading, and vegetation removal, is a little bit of a combination of new and old. And one, we just added that there's the minor pruning of vegetation for view enhancement may be allowed through consultation with the department. So it's better than just saying may be allowed. Well, how? And that could be something as simple as a phone call or sending pictures or something.
Well, and actually, if I could follow up on that, because that's a huge issue. You know, you've got CCNRs, I get a view. The lot owner says, I don't want to cut any trees. The people above say, I want to cut all the trees. And so we're going to do minor view enhancement. I assume, Steve, you're just going to do what you do now, go out to the site? And,
yes,
and,
essentially. Okay. Yes, if it's complex, then we'll require a site evaluation permit, and we have a very good protocol developed for that. We might actually, maybe it might be good to bring that that application package for site evaluation, because then people can see, oh, that's for view enhancement or whatever. And then we review it, often require an arborist involved, and then if it's on a slope, then geotechs are often involved too if there's tree removal proposed.
It's very complicated. Well, I think it's worked pretty well, though, actually. But so that's the concept. Yes. Let's keep doing what we're doing.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
And that gets to number two there, which is we added that there's no removal of vegetation from the landslide hazard area without the danger tree process, the arborist or the management plan.
Tom?
Yes. What I'm looking for is a kind of a recognition that removing forest cover at some distance from what we might consider a geologic hazard area can lubricate the geologically hazardous area. Is there any concern or consideration of that kind of problem anywhere?
Absolutely. Now, one of the changes that is before us, I think that is also involved in the stormwater code, and that's absolutely critical because we have tied in the stormwater code that has changed rather drastically in relation to our old critical area ordinance and how we deal with tree removal, removal of brush, understory, anything like that. Those components are critical to the stability of a slope, and really within 200 feet of a slope in our stormwater code, and it's again become reiterated in this update of the critical area ordinance, that within 200 feet of the top of a slope, we may ask a geotechnical evaluation to occur based on what the stormwater is going to do, because often there's a stormwater path for infiltration purposes, and that our new stormwater code requires that as the number one check off of the list, if you will, is to provide uptake of the water with existing vegetation on a property.
Is that you're not assuming that that the hydrologic change only occurs within 200 feet, that is going to affect the stability of the slope? It would seem that the way Kitsap is built, it could be as much as 2,000 feet where you're at.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. But I think we're talking about, well, where we would look at that critical analysis would be with the degree of the slope, for instance. Well, if we have a 70% slope, we're certainly going to have more scrutiny on a 70% slope and dealing with setbacks and requiring the geotech, which is the safety net for any kind of lawsuit with the county. We want to make sure that the geotech is the one who makes the recommendation, you know.
Are the geotechs professional? Do they have a professional stamp? I mean, we're talking about someone who risks their reputation, right?
Yeah. The errors and omissions on a geotech and their insurance in and of itself is very, very solid in relation to the risk assessment and that type of thing. You know, we do that now, so this really isn't that big of a change, but one of the things we were talking about in relation to the Title 12 stormwater code is that our stormwater code says, oh, well, within 200 feet, if you're going to be discharging stormwater, the mechanism to address that is through the geotech, because that's that, as you say.
Well, instability. I'm thinking about the infiltration of stormwater. Uh-huh. If it's infiltrated, yep. It can still lubricate if it travels.
It can, but the geotech will do the analysis to determine whether or not that's safe to do so. And that's why we've incorporated that here. Yeah. Yeah.
The remainder of that subsection has been retained. So 415, the designation of geologically hazardous areas is an entirely new section, a new paragraph. There's three main points here that this chapter designates, defines, and provides criteria for identification of geologically hazardous areas. Project proponents are responsible for determining whether such a hazard exists, and the department will verify on a case-by-case basis using the criteria in this chapter. And then thirdly, the county maintains some maps of potentially geologically hazardous areas. They are for informational purposes only and may not accurately represent all such areas. We call that out specifically in this chapter, but I would also add that this actually applies to all critical areas, and that's language coming from the state. They say that we need to clarify that our maps are for informational purposes only. So then we're going to move into subsection 420, which is erosion hazard areas. And as we discussed previously, these sections are broken up by hazard type here to start with. So how we identify is broken up by the hazard type. So for erosion, the first part A is just a basic definition of what the hazard is. B is the potential erosion hazards. So what is on the map? This is how you can see what we used to map the maps that you see. So high hazard erosion areas are going to be your channel migration zones and your coastal erosion areas. Your moderate hazard erosion areas are going to be areas identified by NRCS through the Kitsap County Soil Survey. Slopes 15% or greater, that part was existing, it's been retained. And then the coastal erosion with the higher, we call it sediment source rating value. So more hazardous, more potential for coastal erosion in those areas.
Question,
yes.
If I could. Item number two, areas of moderate erosion hazard references, like you said, the Kitsap County Soil Survey.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just referencing this now. I guess, you know, depending upon your soil classifications, most of the soils are type C soils in Kitsap County. It doesn't really say how it has to be classified. It only has to say moderate erosion hazard in the manual. I guess I think this affects an awful lot of property within Kitsap County. And then I guess I'm curious what this means if then you're submitting something and all of a sudden you have something that's not necessarily a steep slope or you're not around slopes, but if you read it, it does say that it's a moderate hazard for erosion. If all of a sudden it's throwing you into some other category that maybe typically wouldn't be dealing with and it doesn't look like it's really practical.
I can talk pretty loud. One of the things that is the variation with the I'll pop up. One of the things that is critical in relation to the Soil Conservation Service, which was the agency at the time, now the Natural Resources Conservation Service, is the mapping level of mapping that was done. Based on soil type, talks about slopes and erosion hazard areas for slopes that are greater than 15%. So slopes between 15% to 30% are typically how we'll review those kinds of applications, and is what we've done throughout time, if you will, in the last iteration of the critical area ordinance. So it's more so about slope percentage than it is about the specific soil type that you'll find. So when you look at our geologically hazardous area now, you'll see moderate hazard as a pink kind of layer, and then more of a dark red for high hazard areas. That demarcation is not always accurate. So we typically go by the topography, because the soil survey in 1981, I believe, when it was published, was from aerial photography review and through stereoscopes and things like that. So they didn't know exactly what the percentage of those slopes were. So we have always guided that as the inclination, if you will, on slopes, more so than about the specific hazard. Yeah. But that's a good point. We're going to continue to do that.
Okay. Yeah, anyway, when we go through that, might be an item we might want to at least tie those two together, because they appear to be independent right now. Because the next one says slopes 15% or greater.
And that may be an error, so we'll double check that.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. So for C, erosion hazard indicators. So these are indicators that can be used by the project proponent, by the geologist, by review staff, as things to keep an eye out for that may indicate that this hazard could be on the site. And for erosion hazards, it's any of the criteria that were used in the mapping that maybe have been amended or updated. So we want to make sure we're using the most current information. There's criteria for coastal erosion hazards that have been added here, as well as channel migration zones with evidence of past migration over the past 100 years. So 0.425, landslide hazard areas. Same layout. We have A is the general section, the definition. B is the potential landslide hazard areas. So what is on the map? Again, the high hazard areas are going to be shallow landslide areas with what's called a factor of safety. And there is a whole methodology, a whole study behind that that you can review in the best available science bibliography. It's a method for slope stability based on the angle of the slope that's from LIDAR elevation data and strength parameters, areas with slopes greater or equal to 30%. And all deep-seated landslides are categorized as high landslide hazard areas. For moderate landslide hazard areas, shallow landslide areas with a factor of safety numbers range that's different than high. The slopes of 15% or greater not classified as these type of soils as highly erodible. So you got the 15% slopes, but not classified as highly erodible by NRCS as it was with the erosion hazards. And then all slopes in all areas equal or greater than 40%. And just as we had with erosion hazards, there's a pretty long list that we've added here of landslide hazard indicators. So this is not an exhaustive list, but it's a pretty decent one.
So Kathleen, does the presence of any one of these indicate I fall within that category? Again, there's no weighing, there's no process. How does it work?
These like I said, they're more instructive than regulatory, I suppose. It's something that if someone from the county or the geologist or DNR, geotech, whoever, they go out to the site, knowing that these are the kind of things they're going to be looking for, or if you're a homeowner, being, you know, maybe these are things you might want to be thinking about. If you're applying for a project, knowing that if I have one of these made, I might need a geologist to come out to my site.
But specifically, we were talking at the open house about a situation where the county map says, hey, this is a moderate landslide area. And homeowner says, baloney. You know, that's I don't have that here. So you say, well, get a geologist, and here's the things the geologist needs to look for. And so I don't. So just geologists comment on all these 14 items and then, you know, reach a decision? Is that kind of what we're thinking?
The geologist has their own training and background education, right, is going to make that determination.
Right.
So they probably are looking at all of these items. The county is certainly, who may not have that particular background, would make, keep an eye on in the report for maybe some of these indicators. They don't have a shall associated with them, I guess is my point.
And so, but then again, if the geologist comes in and says, geez, county, your map is wrong. Nobody's been able to see your map until it's adopted. And now your map is wrong. Here's why. There's a process for changing the map, right? That's we can fix an error, right?
Yeah, and I think, as stated earlier, the maps are informational. So it's really what's on the site. All of these critical area sections that are really going to determine kind of the standards that would be applied. So if there is a question of, you guys got it wrong, the map is wrong, then that would be, you know, more justification for making sure that there is an actual site visit by either a geotech or a geologist to confirm or deny that allegation.
So 430 is the same setup for seismic hazard areas. Again, A is added the definition. B is the potential seismic hazard areas, the what's on the map. Our high hazard areas right now are defined as the faults with evidence of rupture at the ground surface. And we don't have too many of these in Kitsap County. However, our moderate hazard areas are identified on the map as areas that are susceptible to seismically induced soil liquefaction. So your hydric soils, your filled areas, your wetlands could potentially be susceptible to that. Areas identified as, it's called seismic site class D, E, and F, and this is a DNR. It's a building code determination of how you build a structure based on the site class. And then faults without recognized evidence of rupture at the ground surface, but they have been inferred as to where approximately the fault line is, those are considered moderate hazard areas.
The Seattle fault is a good example of that, mm-hmm. where it's shown and it's evident on Bainbridge Island, as many of you are probably aware, and then as it traces across and then up over Chico and that neck of the woods, well, where is it? Where's the rupture zone? Well, we don't know exactly where it is, but we certainly know that there's a fault trace that goes through and that would trigger further studies.
And again, the seismic hazard indicators are listed there as well in C. So those are how we identify, map, those are geologically hazardous areas, and then 435 are the development standards for those. So erosion and landslide hazard development standards, so we've combined those two together because they are so similar and they do often overlap. added that, for one, development not allowed unless there's no alternate location, and that the geological assessment can demonstrate that there that development would be safe.
Kathleen, again, this one just doesn't makes no sense. I'm in urban low. I can build 9 units per acre. I've got an acre, and it's on a 15% slope. My geotech says it's fine. Bedrock. Go ahead and build your 9 units, okay? The abutting property is rural residential, 5 acres. Same hill. You know, it's a beautiful view of Seattle and the mountains. It's the same hill. Geotech says it's fine. Sorry, guy in rural residential, you can't build because there's another building site on your property. Explain to me how that makes any sense in terms of it's okay to build 9 units, but it's not okay to build 1. I would no alternative site. What we're doing is taking all the rural residential areas and saying, boy, if you've got a little place with a view, too bad, so sad. You're going to have to build down low in the forest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we can look at that. And maybe something as simple as changing that and to an or. So it's...
I would suggest to strike it out. I think Steve did a good job explaining. What we're doing is risk averseness. I've got a geotech engineer who's willing to put his stamp on this, saying it's safe. Why are we throwing this extra criteria? I don't understand why we need that.
Okay. Noted. Thank you. Two is the top of slope building setback. We've added that this is all activities requiring permits or clearing in erosion and landslide hazard areas. Just, it's a clarification point. We've retained all of the minimum setbacks. So the 25-foot minimum native vegetation beyond the top of slope and the minimum 15-foot building setback is what's in code now. That has been retained. And A and B additionally are the same as far as the standards go. So for high landslide hazard areas, we retain the setback of height of slope plus the greater of 1/3 vertical slope height or 25 feet. And B, for the moderate hazard areas, retains the 40-foot from top of slope setback.
And I know I'm interrupting that. I apologize, but this is an area that I see a lot of. You said we're maintaining the 40-foot, but if I'm within 200 feet, I have to have a geotech. So as what we're really doing is we've got a 200-foot setback that can be reduced to 40 if a geotech says it's okay. Isn't that a better way to then say, hey, we're keeping the 40? No, we're not. We've got a 200 feet subject to reduction. Isn't that a fair way to say that?
There's nothing in here other than maybe a geotech recommending a 200-foot setback that would call out for a 200-foot setback. We're saying if you're looking at the map and your development site, where you are physically developing on your property, is within 200 feet of a mapped potential geologically hazardous area, then yes, we want to have someone go to make sure that that is in fact the case. And then there are different different means for them to make that determination. If they go off the site and go, there isn't any, this the map is wrong, stamp a letter, versus doing a whole report, which is very costly. So we've tried to make it more of a tiered geological geotech system for that reason.
So just out of curiosity, the determination of general observation in a letter as opposed to soil logs, borings, is that defined in here, or is that just something that staff makes a determination on?
Yeah, that's further on. We'll get into the review procedures. Okay. But remind me if I don't bring that up. Sorry, I just lost my place momentarily. Seismic hazard indicators. So we talked about the seismic hazard development standards in B. Yeah. Okay. And then the second one there was that the development activities or actions requiring a project permit within a seismic hazard area shall be reviewed in accordance with chapter 1404 of this code. That part is the same. Now we're into review procedures. So this is where we get into how this happens. So A is the map review for potentially hazardous areas. So the, again, provide an indication of where these hazard areas may be located within the county. The department will complete a review of the map to determine if the proposed activity is located within a hazard area. A geological assessment will be required when the proposed activity is located within a potential hazard area. A geotechnical professional is the one that's going to go out to the field and identify that and determine whether or not the site for the proposed activity is located within 200 feet of that hazard. And then this is where we talk about what that could be submitted in the form of. So a letter, when they find no hazard exists within 200 feet of that site. A report, when they find that, okay, there is a hazardous area within 200 feet of the site, but it's not going to impact the site or need engineering design recommendations. And then lastly was the geotechnical report. When they find that there is the hazard area that exists within 200 feet, and it is going to require engineering design and recommendations. So that's sort of the tiered approach for the review of that. And then the department will review and either accept the geological assessment and approve the application or reject and require revisions or additional information.
So the difference between two and three, he's going to do the report, so he's going to come out and dig borings, take the soil logs. He's going to prepare a report, but it doesn't have to provide engineering recommendations on whatever the project is.
And a geologist by licensure cannot provide engineering recommendations. They can only talk about slope stability. So that's their role in relation to slope stability. Geotech also will roll in those situations, as we explained earlier, about stormwater control too, so that if there's infiltration that occurs within that zone, they're also going to provide those recommendations. And that happens now. So if we have any infiltration that's proposed within 200 feet of the top of a slope, moderate hazard or higher slope, then the geotech is already incorporated. So we're just adding that extra factor of safety, if you will, for assurances to make sure the development proposal is also by itself not going to be problematic.
Okay. Last two sections here. 445 is the independent consultant review. So this is a provision for all critical areas, but due to the highly technical nature and complexity of these reports, we just want to know the outside resources may be needed to ensure compliance, and we happen to be lucky right now on staff. We do have the expertise, but that may not always be the case. 450, recording and disclosure. So this is right now this is written as an attachment, if you will, to the notice to title for critical areas. It would include an abstract and a description of the risks identified in the geotech report. Sometimes you have this notice to title and you don't know what it means or what did the report even say? So we want to have an abstract and description for that. A statement of understanding and risk of responsibility to disclose to future buyers. And a statement of non-liability of the county for assuming risks. Again, that's why there's so much reliance on the geotechnical engineers. They are the ones putting their stamp on this and saying this is going to be safe. And the county is reviewing it to ensure that it's consistent with code. Oh, the notice to title in general? Right. So in general, notice to title is a discretionary item. It's not something that is required by the state. So that is something we are looking into right now.
Question. Have you ever rejected a geological assessment from a geotechnical engineer to date, just out of curiosity? You have? Has that been like one or two times in your career?
Yes. No names. A couple of times. Yes.
Okay.
What typically has happened is that in that situation, there would be a third-party review if there was an appeal of that particular decision. But there have been two instances I can think of.
And the independent consultant review? I'm just curious. I mean, you know, some jurisdictions right now have peer review for most of your environmental items. It's kind of it's much nicer
Poles,
when it's when
I think City of Poles voted.
I wasn't
going
to use any names.
Yeah,
but okay.
I believe so.
I think perhaps they do too.
That's a good example.
Yes,
a northern city in Kitsap County. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
That's obviously another discretionary item
right
there. Place. Okay.
Yep.
The end of that chapter. 500 frequently flooded areas. This is what you have. Just added again the special consideration to anadromous fish habitat in combination with chapter 19300 fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas and title 22 shoreline master program.
So there's nothing in here that says if you have a steep slope, a floodplain, and a shoreline that you just can't build on at all, is there? I just want to make sure. Okay.
It would depend on where you build in that situation.
It may not be a large home.
Yeah, if you get 3 out of 4. No, it's
right.
I had one of them.
So, chapter 16, critical aquifer recharge areas. 605, the purpose paragraph. So these first additions are based on changes to the WAC chapter. They've added potable water is an essential life-sustaining element for people and many other species. And because the majority of Kitsap County drinking water comes from groundwater supplies and aquifers, these areas are important to ensure the quality and quantity of shallow and deep water aquifers. And then it goes on to explain the reasons why contamination is difficult and costly to restore, and then it can create depletions of potable water supplies. We've added, the water quantity issue has been added here, so water quality and quantity. Directly or indirectly contaminating. That's all language, again, from the WAC, words and phrases that have been added there. So for A, we have added this statement. So preventing degradation of the quality and, if needed, the quantity of potable groundwater. And the if needed is there is because further on you'll see there is a statement allowing for if future information comes up that may supplement the maps and may supplement how we review. So if new information comes up about the quantity supplies in Kitsap County watersheds, we will have this language in there, but it says if needed. And again, another addition in D from the WAC. They stressed that there's a balance for competing needs for water supply, especially for maintaining critical fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas, needs to be considered. Six ten, critical critical aquifer recharge area categories. So the first change you'll see is down here in A2. And rather than the sea level location being used here, a more kind of universal approach was to include areas which are not separated from the underlying aquifers by an impermeable layer that provides adequate protections from contamination to the aquifers below. So you'll get the layer of clay or other types of soils that are not as permeable, and so your risk of contamination is lower in those areas because it wouldn't penetrate down.
Is the assumption here that the layer is continuous across Kitsap, or is it discontinuous and will allow contamination at some other point?
I don't know.
It's just the way the place has been carved up by glaciers, and it's just, you know, there's patchy areas of impervious soil. But it stops, and it may lead to my well. I don't know.
Or it may surface.
It's what?
Or it may surface.
True. True. Yeah.
We've updated the WAC there in 3. So in A4, this is what I was talking about, how the department may add, reclassify, or remove Category 1 critical aquifer recharge areas based on additional information about areas of significant potable water supply with susceptibility to groundwater contamination, and we've added or supply reduction. Again, this is the water quantity component we've added in here. Or based on changes to sole source aquifers or wellhead protection areas as identified in wellhead protection programs. And that's why this chapter, there's a lot of coordination going on between our water purveyors, the health department, other entities to make sure that the experts are really feeding into this review and have participation. So there may be new information that they feed to us that helps us to update the maps or update how we're reviewing for those areas.
Just a question while we're at break here. What is the process for updating the map? Is it a formal process, or just, hey, we got some new information in from the PUD, let's stick it on the map? How does that actually work?
I don't know that we would typically just update a map without some kind of process or during an actual code update. The way this is worded, this is by and large existing language, that the department can add, reclassify, or remove those areas based on further information. So it would be either a programmatic change, or it may be site-specific. B2 may have been a typo there, so that the not should not be struck there. B5 was added for consistency. So now with B, we're talking about Category 2 aquifer recharge areas, and A, we were talking about Category 1s. It's the same paragraph we were just discussing. And then C talks about the mapping. So the county, in coordination with the water purveyors and other agencies, produces the map indicating the locations and their defining characteristics, but doesn't indicate when. Mm-hmm. 615, development standards. So for A2, again, we've added that quantity component coming from the WAC, and we've corrected the name of Kitsap Public Health from Health Department. For B2, the need for a hydrogeological report, it did say additional information, so we've clarified by additional information we mean hydrogeological report will be determined when the proposed land use or activity may impact groundwater and surface water quality and quantity. And again, the quality land use issues are in the table in section 620. So those are the types of land use that have a potential to threat groundwater quality. And then the groundwater quantity, again, to be determined. The back to C, notification and review. So the affected water purveyors, tribes, and the public health, Kitsap Public Health, will be notified and invited to comment during the preliminary phases of the county's review of any development application in a critical aquifer recharge area. They could review the process on the proposed land use and impacts, but it's not only the process they're commenting on, it's the actual land use. So that's just a little clarification change there. And three has been struck. The appeal to the hearing examiner was removed simply because Title 21 already covers this process. And again, deleting things that are redundant throughout code as much as possible, so when one is updated, we don't end up with our wires crossed. And stormwater, an update there to say best management practices in accordance with Title 12 rather than just encouraging infiltration, being a bit more specific. Okay. And then the table has not been updated, or didn't. It was reviewed and did not warrant updating at this time. On to special reports then, 700. So we have, the first one is sort of a description for all the special reports and the purpose for A. We want to protect or mitigate the impact to critical areas, not mitigation to the critical areas themselves, but the impact to the critical areas. So that was a clarification there. B is really just a cleanup. It was kind of a grammatical mess, but the intent and the language is really the same there. And the bottom of section C here, we've updated for to say the Title 19 reference, was edited, and then also Title 21 of this code. Just some little changes here on D, qualifications of professionals. Any special report required herein shall be prepared and signed by the professionals identified below and in Chapter 19500. It's often at times where you'll have multiple individuals working on a report from a particular company or agency, and we want to make sure we have everyone who's worked on the report listed and identified.
We might also want to include wet stamping on reports too for this part. We could have their signature, but if they don't have their professional affiliation and stamp, then, well, when we review those, we say, hey, we're
stamped. Signed, stamped.
Yeah.
All right, we're moving into 710, the wetland delineation report. So this first section A here was it is new, but it was brought entirely in from our wetlands chapter, and this is just describing how long these reports are valid for, that information that was already, it was in code. We just moved it here.
I guess before you move on, is this for someone prepares a report and either it's not constructed, or is this saying you prepare a report, you build it in compliance with the report, do everything you're supposed to do, and then all of a sudden someone says something's changed, that you can actually, I mean, you're not extending. When I look at a report and I get a permit and you complete it and your project is final, you've met the conditions. I guess I'm not, this does not open that door, does it? Because it almost sounds like it does.
What it's saying is that the delineation reports are valid for 5 years. So if you had the, if you did the report 3 years ago and then you don't submit for your application for your development until, I mean, after 3 years, that report would still be valid. After 5 years, conditions will have changed in the watershed on the site and hydrology may be different. So we're going to want to ensure that there's more recent information. I mean, that standard is in code now. It's just moved here with the report language.
Okay, I'll just look at the text. I thought there was something here that almost sounded like you could actually retroactively go back with something constructed and say, gee, you know what? Your wetlands changed, and as we know, everything's changing all the time. So
we do have situations where, say, for instance, we'll have a preliminary plat, and then it just takes a while to go through, or maybe there was a funding problem or who knows what. Mm-hmm. But if there's a significant delay, what we'll typically ask for from that professional would be an addendum report. This would then address, hey, this wetland is the same wetland, it's the same situation. At the point of the preliminary plat, there's vesting, obviously, with the preliminary plat. And then, you know, that's not really a change. It's just further demarking how we do that now.
So moving on to B, this is what the wetland delineation report shall include. For two, right now we already have that. We want a copy of the National Wetland Inventory. And then we've also added a copy of any known previous delineations or investigations. Doesn't mean you have to go hunt them down, but if they're known. C, a copy of the forms used to delineate the wetland. And that's provided in the wetland delineation manual. So we want to see the actual scoring and ranking or the methodology that went into that delineation. And then we have our site map in 3, which is pretty much the same, except for when we get to H. We've changed with technology. We wanted to update this one. So the department may require, we're saying now that the department the most recent dated air photo with overlays displaying the site boundaries and wetland delineations. So this is something we want to see in the report now. It's not that the department may require, because these things are available on Google Earth. They're readily available now. Again, technology has changed. Down on 5, discussion of the wetland boundary. The delineation report shall delineate the entire wetland boundary. If the wetland extends outside of the site, then the delineation report needs to discuss the methods for delineation beyond the site if physical access was not granted. And so, again, these remote mapping methods can be used, but that just needs to be noted in the report that this wasn't a physical, the whole wetland could not be delineated because of access or what have you. But again, the remote methods are readily available now. And it's very difficult to actually rate a wetland without having the full picture and the whole delineation. So that is a requirement. For 6, the general site conditions within 1/4 mile of the subject wetland. So that includes things like topography, surface areas of all the wetlands identified, including ditches and streams. So the 1/4 mile piece actually came from the end of that paragraph. It was just moved up for clarity. With 7, when you're doing the hydrological analysis, so that's the topography, existing surface and known significant subsurface flows in that subject wetlands, and the location of the wetland within the watershed. It's important to have an understanding hydrologically of where this wetland is in the watershed and what role it plays in the watershed for hydrology purposes. For eight, habitat and water quality have been added to the functions and values to analyze, and that's just to be consistent with our definition and understanding of functions and values. And 10, the rationale for the wetland category recommendation and a copy of the rating form. So for C2, there's what we used to have is called a plant community assessment. And this is no longer recognized as an appropriate delineation method, so that has been struck. And then for C3, adding that delineation stakes really need to remain in place until after final inspection when permanent buffer signs are installed. Often what can happen is the delineation boundary is staked out, and then prior to final inspection it's pulled out, and there may be other agencies that need to come out and take a look at that. And so we want to keep those in place until final inspections and permanent signs, if needed, have been installed. Okay, so now we're moving on to our wetland mitigation report. So this first part that you see here, again, is moved entirely from 19200 to 50C. So it moved from the wetland chapter here. Just so we're all keeping it together here. And then for A, we've added the cover and title page, and B, the table of contents. These were added, these were not explicitly identified in the current code, and so we want to make sure that our reports are getting these things. Responsible parties was added. Again, this is what I was talking about earlier with the multiple parties working on a report. We want to have all that information. And who's going to be doing the monitoring? Who's going to be doing, who did the delineation? Who's doing the mitigation report? We want to have all those parties identified. D, the executive summary. We have added in D3 the description of land use proposal and its location, and 4, description of the measures taken to avoid and minimize the impacts to the wetland and other aquatic resources. So we want to kind of show your work, show your mitigation sequencing. How did you avoid? How did you minimize? How did you get to needing a mitigation report? And 5 was struck because it's a similar to what we put in 4. So the new 5 here, describe both the impacts and the proposed mitigation. So that was a clarification point there. And then the points here for B and E, again, clarifications. This is the coward and wetland classification, and then the wetland functions. Seven, explanation of other unavoidable impacts to other aquatic resources, which are not just waters of the state. So we changed that there. And 8, other relevant details, including but not limited to. And these items are, this first one was the goals and objectives. Proposed improvements to the functions and environmental process of the larger watershed, proposed buffers for the compensatory mitigation site. So E and F, what we've done here is they describe the development impact. So So E is the project description, and F is going to be, okay, what is going to be the, what are going to be the impacts? So I'm rambling now, sorry. So to clarify, we've added in E, not just the project size, but the development project size. So this is indicating this is about your development project description. Project location, added some pieces we'd like to see in those maps, including the watershed. And then a description of the development site itself. So any historic and current land uses, zoning map, existing wetlands on or adjacent, other aquatic resources. And then moving on to F, the ecological assessment impact. We want a description of the impacts, description of the temporary, indirect, and direct impacts. 2 and 3 were struck. Those are items that we moved into E because they describe the current conditions. And we've added detail throughout here. So you'll see that on 5, 6, 7, and so on, the titles remain the same. What we've done is added clarifying pieces of what that means, what we need to see to make a determination. So things like the description of the water regime, okay, these are the things that we're going to need to see. Description of the soils, so that's the soil survey map, a map showing soil sampling locations, a description of the plant communities. So those are all items that, again, are from the best available science documents that we've reviewed. These are what these pieces, these components mean. So that continues on through each of these, through 10. So then G and H, the next subsections, those describe the mitigation site or the approach taken for mitigation. So those, the E and F were your development site. Now we're talking, okay, now what, how are you going to mitigate that? What is on site? What's your mitigation approach? So for one, G1, we want you to show that mitigation sequencing was followed. So explaining how each step of mitigation sequencing was followed up to compensatory mitigation. And then 3 is that we have added a brief description of the strategies to achieve those goals. H is the proposed mitigation site. 1C, it currently just says current past land use. I want to say include also a description of the constraints at the mitigation site that could affect the success of the mitigation project and strategies used to address each constraint. So what could affect success of this project? Are there any factors that we need to be considering? 2 is the site selection rationale, and we've added discussion of how the mitigation site fits in with the needs of the watershed. Three, existing baseline ecological conditions. So A through C and F through L, those are existing elements again, but detail is added to each as to what is expected in each description. In D, we have added a description. This is a new, notice that the title is new as well. So this is an entirely new piece. Description of other aquatic resources on the mitigation site and adjacent properties. That's been added. And then further on, down to M, has also been added information on water quality where applicable. And again, that whole mention of adjacent properties, remote tools are encouraged. They're you can use those. So then for I, preliminary site plan, we've said we want a qualitative description of the water regime here rather than just saying explain. How the adequate hydrology will be provided to support a wetland over the long term, especially if you're creating a wetland, that is very, very important. Two, discussion on how the project will provide proposed functions, including how hydrologic data will support it, the rationale for each function, and design features to achieve that function. And then the schematic drawings, these are again just sort of clarification points through A through F here. And then for J, final site plan design, we've added detail to all existing elements, again, of what is expected for each description. We have, of course, the site survey and topography, water regime, soil amendments, and landscape plans and construction specifications are all laid out over the next couple of pages.
Question? Contour intervals of 6 inches.
Where's that?
C, page 116. I guess I've never seen a topographical map with a contour interval of 6 inches. I was wondering, was there a situation or something where...
Again, this is a review of Vestaville Science, and this was a recommendation from Department of Ecology, so... We'll look at that.
For wetland mitigation sites, 6 inches, the difference in 6 inches, it's actually pretty large when it's coming to, you know, distributing vegetation types or hummocks in the restoration or specific features for aquatic organisms. 6 inches can be the difference between, you know, open water, small habitat for amphibians.
Mm-hmm.
And if that isn't designed so that there's the adequate amount of water staying in that particular feature and it dries up, and then there's no, you know, you end up with frog spawn that never gets to the next stage. So,
okay.
Yeah. That's not unusual in a restoration to have that kind of dialed in.
Good question.
Had a question here back on 3D, line number 1 on 112. And we say,
mm-hmm.
Right. And you're talking about adjacent properties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that taking, I take it by saying adjacent properties, we're saying that there's mitigating resources there. Now, isn't that kind of like putting a lien on that property that, you know, my project goes through, but now if that property wants to do something, how is this documented that, well, we already accounted for that?
Well, again, it's this just description of the aquatic resources on the mitigation site and the adjacent properties. So you're not in any way imposing any kind of standards to that property. You're just saying, it's just like taking a wetland or a watershed approach to your review. I mean, the surrounding area can significantly impact your mitigation site, and you need to take those into account. So it isn't putting any sort of constraint on any adjacent properties by including that in this evaluation.
Not sure I buy it.
No trespass that, you know, inferred in any of that. It's typically what the consultant will do is they'll just do a
Oh, no, no. No, I'm talking about your end result of, okay, I see this area over here, you know, and I aerial photographs and all that, I map that out and I say, all right, that's offsetting what my project's going to do. Well, you've just put a lien on the other property.
Yes, but I don't think.
Well, I'm just.
But they would not let you do that unless you actually approach the neighbor and receive some type of an easement of some type or another that would allow that area of property to stay preserved. So, I mean, I just know going through this and looking at various options and possibilities that they're not going to let you, you know, do anything that's going to tie up the neighbor's property. You can't say I'm going to use that benefit over there unless you actually obtain that benefit.
I'd give a further example in relation to, say, a wetland that's created through beaver dams.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a flood that happens, and we just happen to design a particular project for incorporating that particular wetland that's off-site. Obviously, it's going to affect the neighboring property. But the fact is that in a storm event, that beaver dam, if they move out, they're not going to restore that and recreate the dam, so we can have an effect of a problem too. So, you know, we have the situations that do happen where.
Okay, so basically, when you're looking at a special report, there is consideration given on, well, wait a minute, if they say we have mitigating adjacent property.
Right.
You're saying, wait a minute.
But we're not locking that property up. I mean, we're not holding everything to that particular property off site. It's just the fact of the existing condition that is an effect on the property that the mitigation is going to occur.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's no off-site mapping that happens as well with identifying critical areas in a special report that comes in either. So we're not going to map something off-site that is part of a special report. It's just that they're identifying it for the design purposes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I believe we're on page 119 under M, the maintenance and contingency plans. This added, we've added detail to all the existing elements of what is expected in each description. The implementation schedule under N, we've added this sort of construction sequence and time schedule, including, okay, when's your start date? What are some key events in the project? And noting that implementation delays may result in increased mitigation. And a lot of that has to do with the temporal loss. So if you built your project and you're not able to do the mitigation for years, that could have a temporal loss of those functions and values. So that's in there. And then that they will submit an as-built of the mitigation. So we have that on the record as well, which, of course, helps with the monitoring. Under performance bonds, clarifying that typically what we see is the amount is 1.5 times the estimated cost of mitigation. It does not tie that down. It just makes a statement that that is typically what we see.
Now, just out of curiosity, to clarify this, this is a performance bond. But it says this bond is going to stay in place for 5 years after completion. But it's in the same section.
So the bond assignment or savings or security will be released no earlier than 5 years, and that was a change based on, it was understood to be a typo rather than released no later than 5 years.
Well, I guess my point is a performance bond is put in place when someone has not performed, and that's why it is in excess of the dollar amount required to actually complete the work. Once the work's done, the performance bond should be released. If you're worried about whether plants are going to survive, it shouldn't be a maintenance bond, and it should be a percentage less than 100, because, you know, I can't imagine losing all the plants. So usually, you know, quite often maintenance bonds for like water or something like that are 20% of the cost. So it seems like it should be something that's less than 100, because you're simply making sure that you're replacing plants that didn't survive. But reality of it is you're not going to replace 100% of them, because you're just looking at the ones that didn't make it. So you might want to take a look at that and maybe rephrase that and change the percentages.
Yeah, because we do have a separate mitigation bond in our current CAO where that's separated out. Performance is performance occurs, done to the plan, et cetera, and so forth. The report then is provided. We review the report and release the performance bond. And you're right that then there's an associated mitigation bond that we ask the wetland specialist to provide, and then we review that. And the same similar assignment of account can happen too. So
right.
Or the other thing, so that should be
yes.
We'll
look at that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, 720 Habitat Management Plan. So for A here, you'll notice there's changes to the priority habitats and species. We're just saying, and all applicable volumes and revisions, because they do update it periodically. And then the National Bald Eagle Management Guidelines have been added rather than the rules in the WAC, as we've discussed. B and C, those are typos that we just corrected. It should be North Arrow, not North Areas. And C3, a discussion on how the applicant proposes to avoid, minimize, and mitigate. So we want, again, showing that avoidance and minimization of mitigation sequencing. D1, we've added this sort of, we haven't added the order sequence, but when you're establishing a buffer zone, there's an order of sequence for buffer reductions. And we've added that the first one really needs to be a reduction of the building setback where possible. And then moving into the buffer averaging that we've discussed, et cetera. And for two, added a discussion of connection to existing wildlife corridors. So you may recall when we discussed that way back at the beginning of this evening, we've added that purpose, D, to that chapter. So preservation of native plants and trees is essential to maintaining habitat function, including connection to existing wildlife corridors. So that was added there. So the geological assessments, there weren't a whole lot of changes made here, even though we made a lot of changes to the actual chapter. The section title changed. Instead of the geotechnical report and geological report, we're referring to them as geological assessments as the umbrella term. So that did change. Adding that the assessment may be in the form of a letter, geological report, or geotechnical report. And then those, the rest remained the same. There were, and we did clarify that the maps were proposed in a potentially geologically hazardous areas. And that's all for special reports. One quick thing here when it comes to our appendices. So for Appendix A is the description of the Washington State Wetland Rating System categories. The points and terms were updated as they were in the wetlands chapter. Appendix B is the DNR stream typing system. type F streams contain habitat for fish, not just some monads, anadromous, or game fish. So that was clarified there. Appendix C is the GIS database. We have updated the priority habitats and species from DFW is now called what it is now. What's in there is an old term. We have added the stream typing of select Raya 15 watersheds. This is the Wildfish Conservancy field mapped streams that we have added to the map, as well as the geologically hazardous areas mapping that we have added as well. The critical area and buffer notice, currently the change here is that the notary has been removed from that, is no longer required. Appendix F, critical area decision types. We've updated for the buffer averaging component we've discussed earlier, about 25% to 50%, and what type of review it would require. We have added a couple of new items. Appendix G is a checklist and sample outline for a delineation report to simplify all of the items that were in the special reports chapters. It's easier to kind of use that. And then Appendix H is a mitigation plan checklist. So similar thing, something to help them go through there and see what would be required in that report. And lastly, Appendix G has been removed, the wetland buffer alteration general authorization form. There were a lot of redundancies built into our current process that made that, it just wasn't utilized anymore, it was redundant. And that is all.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah, it was well done. Good, Kathleen.
Yeah, I need a
drink. This go round.
Yeah.
So, maybe talk a little bit about the hearings. Obviously, April 25th, April 27th, May 2nd. The open house, you'll get input or whatever beforehand. Then we'll start the hearing. You guys will do a little 15-minute intro. We'll open up a public hearing. Depending upon the number of folks there as far as how long we give them to speak. I guess, has there been a pretty good turnout with what you've done so far with the open houses?
So the open houses have been mixed. Mm-hmm. We had probably the best turnout in Silverdale, which was, I think, was around 36 folks that showed up. It was closer to a dozen up in the north end and down here in the chambers. Online, we had close to 700 hits, so our online open house was probably the most successful resource we had for people. These can bring out lots of folks, as you'll see on your, when you start looking at the comment material and the response matrix that's been put together. I think there were 19 separate commenters that are reflected in that, but one commenter alone provided over 250 individual comments on the draft. And so you get people that are very passionate about this information. Now, you know, it's hard to really predict what this mm-hmm. is going to be, and much of the kind of the default standards really aren't changing. I mean, in terms of the buffer widths themselves, there's more information that we're asking for in this as we've gone through and looked at the special reports. There are some new programs in there that allow people kind of a little more flexibility in some places and less in others. So I would suggest, and as has been done in the past, there have been time limits put on testimony. Mm-hmm. You've accepted oral and written testimony. You can, you know, you're basically, I think, continuing the hearing from one day to the next, so you can allow for continued electronic submittals during that time that will go into the record and will be part of your, you know, materials for deliberation. So that typically is how it's been done in the past, was they basically kept the hearing open from one day to the next and then closed it at the end of that last hearing. And then I believe we have deliberation time scheduled for the commission as well. I don't know those dates right off the top of my head. And I think we have at least one day.
We have May 16th beginning in the afternoon at 1 p.m., so it's a little bit late to start, but we also have reserved May 23rd for that as well.
Okay. And we'll have a timer of some type?
We can make that arrangement.
I'm just curious. I mean, typically we give them a certain amount of time. So don't...
Sure. And you may determine how long you want to provide each speaker when you see what the turnout is, whether it's 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 5 minutes.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Yes, I'll make a prediction that due to the excellent pre-work that has done this time around, I think we will have a lot fewer people, a lot less of a controversy.
I would also say the change is not nearly as drastic as it was. Yes. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? All right, if not, thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Here, see, if you look at this development standard, it says, if I